You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Tracy, we are back. It's Saturday. It's a Pathfinder day for me and usually a game day for you, but I don't believe it is a game day today because you have other household projects going on.
Honeydew chores, as it were.
Yeah. But hey, we're back. We're recording.
We are.
Good times.
So, okay. Diving right in here, I have a question. Have you a recollection, Patrick, of reading a comic that isn't about the sorts of things comics are usually about? Have you ever done that before?
Yeah.
Okay. So do you remember what it was?
I remember Ambush Bug.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Robert and I have talked about it quite a bit. Robert, our patron.
Cool.
Back and forth. I also, I enjoyed... there was Eclipse Comics back in the day, had a couple of things that were a little bit different. They had DN agents and they had Crossfire, which would go back and forth between the two because the guy in Crossfire really loved the rainbow haired girl in DN agents whose name I can't remember. So I used to do stuff like that. Yeah.
Fantastic. So we're for today going to spend a minute looking at something a little even farther afield than those sorts of things, because we're talking about how do we use kind of the graphic narrative and art form as a means of exploring things that I think most people don't even think of as having a role in there. We've got A. David Lewis, who's here to talk to us about his latest publication, Body, Soul, and Comics, which is described by the publisher in any case. We'll see what David has to say about it for himself, as a scholarly journey through graphic religion and graphic medicine. So, all right, that might need to be taken down a notch so that our listeners can kind of come in on ground level with you here. Talk about what you do.
Okay. Hi. Thank you. Thank you, Tracy and Patrick. I'm first and foremost just a nerd alongside you guys, and I'm just using really big words to describe my nerdity. The book itself, Body, Soul, and Comics, I'm calling out two things. I'm discussing graphic religion. That is where religion or spirituality or the non-corporeal shows up in comics. You can find that in a lot of fiction. You can also find that in nonfiction, however, people talking about their personal experiences with the divine or the semi-divine or the supernatural, just in comics form. And that's what I studied for a long time. And as I say study, I'm reading superheroes. I'm reading Marvel, DC, Image, and every sort of genre alongside that. But I found that I started to drift in my academic role as a professor, as a college educator, over to graphic medicine as well, which is where comics, sequential art, bande dessinée, manga, you name it, intersects with healthcare, intersects with ideas of well-being, illness, even research, medical research. And though those things are usually held pretty separate from each other, the bodily and the spiritual, the religious and the medical, I've been enjoying playing with the idea that they're not that far apart and that comics is one of the best places to experience them overlapping, sort of having concerns about things in common. What makes us whole, W-H-O-L-E. What makes us human? What feels good? What feels healthy? What feels right? And then inequities, whether that's persecution, whether that's prejudice, whether that's people being marginalized for, again, any of these reasons. The comics language, visual language and verbal language for any of these scenarios is actually quite similar. So that's what my book dives into. And the only other element I'll call out here, almost as an apology, is that there's a little bit of autobiography in it. I didn't want to write this book from the third person omniscient, I am the great scholar and you will listen to me. There's hints of what I've gone through. I don't think it dominates the book, right? I don't think it's a confessional or, you know, a weepy thing, but I do admit that my thinking has shifted as my life has shifted. So that's it in a nutshell. And I would just say, even if people aren't into academia and scholarship and college and high thought, I have to imagine that most people who read comics find ways it relates to them personally. And to that degree, I'm hoping that's an in for readers, for audiences.
Very cool.
So whether we're looking at at, you know, graphic storytelling, like through traditional comics media, you know, heroes like your Green Lantern and your Hulk and your Daredevil and whatnot, who we often have kind of spiritual elements to their particular struggles. There's this kind of Superman as Messiah figure and so on gets trotted around.
Well,
a lot.
DC calls Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman the Trinity.
The Trinity.
Right. I mean, it's not subtle. Not subtle. I mean,
it's not subtle at all.
And so there's already this kind of like baked in language to certain comics of like working in the divine, and sort of thinking about, you know, the body as a superhuman thing or something that transcends the way the human bodies operate. What is it about comics that in your experience and opinion makes them so particularly fertile and useful for looking at these types of ideas?
Great question. And this applies as much to fictional comics as it does to nonfiction or autobiographical or even journalistic comics. I love that comics don't try to be anything but what they are. Now, I'm not saying that in a reductive way. I'm not saying comics are juvenile, and I'm not saying comics are subliterary. I mean, when you go to a movie, the movie wants you to forget you're sitting in a movie theater.
Yeah.
It really would like to immerse you as much as possible. And that's fine. I don't hold that against movies. I just understand that's part of the medium. Audiobooks, too, would like you to forget that maybe this is one voice and it's going to take on a lot of different character properties. When I'm listening to Dungeon Crawler Carl, it wants me to imagine a whole bunch of different voices. But what I love about comics is that it wears its representationality on its sleeve. It doesn't want you to forget necessarily that you're holding a comic. It's not hiding that we're moving from panel to panel, word balloon to word balloon. And in fact, in being sort of unashamed that it's a medium and we're operating in it, it can create really cool techniques. You can move between panels when a character breaks through. I'm thinking of Animal Man, if you remember the Grant Morrison run there. It can get very meta narrative. And what's beautiful about that is that it lets you access these techniques, but it also is inviting the reader to when I deal with graphic religion and Islam, I'm not particularly concerned that there's going to be idolatry here or worship of the human form here, because the comic is very clearly saying we're not real, that we are drawings, that we come from a human hand. Other media might not do that. Right. So you get both the fictional and sort of a greater truth or an emotional truth when you have nonfiction accounts through comics. So there's several reasons I like it, but it keys into the representationality and what the reader has to pull into their mind and actively animate themselves.
It's interesting, I think, because it also puts me in mind of some people who are not familiar with manga will pick them up sometimes and have very little sense of how graphic, in the sense of like the exposure of the human body, for instance, it can be in there.
Oh, yeah.
And there tends to be a certain amount of hand-wringing, you know, particularly from Western readers who either aren't experienced with it or are trying to sort of like import expectations that don't belong there.
There's also an assumption that it's for kids.
Right.
That is an assumption.
Which is an incorrect assumption. But putting that aside, there's also this, and it goes back to what you were saying about the idea of idolatry, David, that the Japanese make no bones about the fact that, like, that's not actually a person. That's a drawing of a person. Like no human is being exploited through the representation of boobs that we have here, for instance. And so there is less anxiety about it, partly because there's less confusion, to your point, Patrick, about who the intended audiences can be, but also less fussiness about the division between reality as we know it amongst ourselves and the fact that the page is just trying to capture a kind of a reality.
But what's funny is though, I had to learn that the hard way because growing up and being raised Catholic, coming across that kind of stuff in a comic book freaked me out.
Oh yeah.
And made me incredibly uncomfortable because, you know, you're taught certain things about the human body and sex and those kinds of things. Like that's all bad. That's all really, really bad.
Yeah.
Like you shouldn't be looking at that. That's gonna, you know, you're going to hell.
Right. Okay.
I encounter that all the time. I hear those responses, those different cultural engagements here. It makes a lot of sense to me. I think what gets left out of the discussion is the role of the reader and really how they choose to absorb these visuals, right? How they choose to animate it in their mind and what sort of agency they're giving to both themselves and to the page. I mean, yeah, if my kid is drawing a stick figure with big boobs, I'm going to be like, oh, come on, man. But I know that's not a realistic depiction. I know that that may not even be sexualized to them. It's just that's what they saw, right? So I do like engaging, particularly stories, nonfiction stories. I'm thinking of Craig Thompson's Blankets here. I'm thinking more recently of Gaytheist, about a Jewish upbringing, but highly observant Jewish upbringing, but discovering that they're gay. I'm thinking of Genderqueer by Maya Kobabe. And the idea that comics is maybe the safest space to engage these things because you can deny that these, you can accept that these are purely representations, not exposure of real bodies, real body parts, real people. And you can dive deeper. You can dive into the body. You can look at body processes. You can look at fertility. You can look at cancer at a level that I'd say prose, or I would say traditional film or cinema, can't.
Yeah. A colleague.
I was going to say, you mentioned cancer, and my brain went to a couple of different mainstream comics that kind of had stuff like that. I believe at one point, like Mary Jane Watson Parker had cancer because of her being close to Peter for so long. And then you also had Lex Luthor, who ended up with cancer because he kept kryptonite around him all the time.
That's right. And my students and I agree
to him. Yeah.
My students and I actually look at the 1980 graphic volume Death of Captain Marvel as a great example. It's fiction, obviously. Captain Marvel, this isn't the Carol Danvers Captain Marvel. This is Mar-Vell. But it's great because even though it's fiction, it's actually Jim Starlin, the artist and writer, working through his own feelings about his father's cancer and death. And I think in that way, graphic medicine, it makes things really accessible and offers this safe zone that the reader can then say, ah, how does cancer operate in my life? Or if I had a diagnosis, and how can I still do this heroically? Or is that even what I want? It's a great, great text to work off of.
If you were looking at Western stuff, I'm curious, like, did you cover anything about the Comics Code? Because for the longest time, the Comics Code wouldn't let you do anything like that.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting because the Comics Code gives us sort of access to the earliest graphic medicine or early American 20th century graphic medicine because it was all persecuted under Dr. Frederick Wortham and his concerns about child's psychiatric impact, psychological impacts. Yep. So you have a whole nother angle on graphic medicine here, but it was evaluating how comics impact this population in a real way, according to Wortham. This has since been debunked, obviously. But his concern was children's mental health. And that's the only nice thing I can say about Dr. Wortham. He did acknowledge that children have full mental lives, right? And that their environment can have an impact on that. Now, I wildly disagree that comics were going to do anything to kids or that comics are exclusively for kids. But yeah, we do reach back into that. And it creates a whole bunch of who should be the gatekeepers? Should there be gatekeepers? Age restrictions? What should libraries stock? What shouldn't they stock? Brings it right into the modern discussion.
Yeah, yeah. And this is winding back towards some observations made earlier by you, David, about the question of the implicit question I think that some people have about whether or not comics is a serious medium for investigating information. And I think that I've, in my own work in academia, I've seen all layers of responses to that, whether it's from students or parents or from fellow academics. Like years ago, we had as a required summer reading for our students, John Lewis's memoir, The March Trilogy. And we decided that there would be some value in asking the rest of the faculty to read it as well. Or rather, I should say, our principal asked if we would kind of encourage the rest of the faculty to do it. And so we did. And I remember really vividly at a faculty meeting, one member of the department, now the history department, now since retired, went on a really animated tirade about why weren't the students assigned John Lewis's prose memoir? Because, you know, Good Trouble, and that would have been a more valuable and useful read, and that this was all surface level, and that it didn't engage with the history of the civil rights movement as it ought to have done. And around that same time, though, I had a colleague who was teaching a class in my department on science, rhetoric, and communication, in partnership with a biologist. And they did lots of different types of science communication work, from the lab right up to popular science articles. And one of the things they worked with was transforming scientific information and medical information into comics format. And so how do you use graphic sequential art to explore a diagnosis? How do you use graphic sequential art to explain how an mRNA vaccine functions, or so on? And it was fascinating, because that same member of the history faculty, who had like a history of ideas background, wanted to sit in on that class. And so he did. And he happened to sit in on a class where they were talking about how do we translate this body of prose research information into graphic sequential art. And the students were doing that work. And that, he thought, was laudable. That, he thought, was work that ought to have been done. And so people's selectiveness in how they view and categorize comics, where comics are, generally people have fairly formed opinions, I think, about narrative comics one way or the other. They like them or they don't. They think they're good or they think they're not. But when it comes to nonfiction comics, I think that the way in which people respond to it is both more telling and way more complicated. And I'm kind of curious about how that has shown up in some of the work that you've done, some of the work you've done in trying to assess how people respond to this language of comics as it interacts with real world information.
I think it's fortunate that I'm Gen X. And I don't know how many of the listeners are as well, or very good. I think it's fortunate that I'm Gen X, because we were right at the analog digital divide, right? We experienced so many in our youths of shifting media. And I mean, I've personally come to the conclusion that every media has art and every medium has crap. Whether that's video games or Vine videos or TikTok or so forth. Going to your particular point, I totally see the value of John Lewis's prose story, of course, but is that going to hook the population that you're targeting in that moment? I want to discuss cancer and cancer narratives in terms of Siddhartha Mukherjee's The Emperor of All Maladies, but that is a thick book. And maybe I can lead students or other professionals to it through something like Brian Fies's Mom's Cancer, which feels more approachable. It operates in a visual language that might feel less intimidating, but it also might connect more directly with the person. I do agree with Scott McCloud that comics, because of simplifying things visually, I'm not saying comics are simple, but I'm saying simplifying images allows the reader or the audience to project themselves to some degree into the story. I look nothing like Wolverine, whether you're talking Hugh Jackman or you're talking Danny DeVito. But I did relate to Wolverine as a kid because I'm like, oh, even a hero can have anger issues or mental health issues or be short, right? And I don't see that in the Hugh Jackman version necessarily. I'm not saying, oh, I'm very Hugh Jackman-like. I look very much like him. So there is, I have a friend, Matthew Noh, who's a graphic novel librarian, and he recently reminded me that for every book, it's reader, for every reader, it's book. In this specific instance, March is going to attract interest and relate to a population better than throwing John Lewis's prose text at them, even if there's something beautiful and rich about Lewis's work. He did sign off heartily and promoted March widely. So I think that brings a new generation or a new look from sectors that wouldn't have considered this otherwise to the message and the core issues he wanted to express. I feel similarly about religion and about medicine.
The Hugh Jackman thing was a huge controversy at the time.
I know. Really, I remember. Well,
but you know what else was?
It was Doug Gray Scott. Yeah.
What's his face? Oh God. Keaton. Keaton is Batman.
Oh, Michael Keaton is Batman. Mr. Mom. How could Mr. Yeah. Mom be the Dark Knight?
Yeah, exactly.
I absolutely remember. Now people swear by it. Yeah, I was subject to that as well. And then how could Val Kilmer assume the role? I want more Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
We're never – the one thing that can be relied upon with fandom is we're never quite happy with what we've got.
Mm-hmm.
No, so, people are still to this day like freaking out, demanding where's Luke Skywalker?
Mm-hmm.
Like they want something from Luke Skywalker, and it's like Mark Hamill's really old. The only thing you're going to get from him is an animated series, unless they recast the role, right?
Oh, and I'm already hearing shouts, praise, and detractors about the new X-Men casting, right?
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Like, how old should Wolverine be if Jean Grey is depicted in such a way? I don't know. Am I allowed to talk about Spider-Man, or is that spoilers?
I haven't seen it yet, so I'd prefer not to.
I haven't seen it yet either, so.
Okay, I'm saying nothing. I'm saying nothing at all.
But it's hard to avoid spoilers at this point.
That's true.
Sure.
I do think one of the things that I was thinking about, because there's this kind of like academic background to the mm-hmm. approach that you've taken here, and I was actually talking to Husbeast about this earlier today, is Avengers Doomsday coming up in December. I have an intrinsic interest in, because, you know, I'm a Make Mine Marvel girl and have been for many years. But it dawned on me when I saw one of the many hot takes out there on the internet that sort of like breaks down, here are the things you need to make sure that you've seen to be like ready for Doomsday. And I realized mm-hmm. that I had seen just barely more than half of it, and that I would have something like 20 hours of watching homework to do. And it dawned on me that it feels a little bit like there's this weird intersection now of fandom and academia, where now fandom has a syllabus.
Like, oh, yeah.
I could go being like, Doom who? what's this? Who is she? I don't know. Like, I could show up to that film as ignorant as I want, and they will still happily take my money. And that is also fine. But being who I am, I would like to be able to go into it feeling that I'm prepared.
But here's the thing. The people that are making that list have not seen the movie and don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
I mean, it is based off of, like, they've seen it. They saw a trailer and they're like, oh, Shang-Chi's in the trailer. So now you got to watch Shang-Chi. Yeah.
So I don't think you have to worry. It's very similar to, like, when I watch a Star Wars thing, and they give me a little fan service because I also watch The Bad Batch.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And for me, that moment is like, oh, that's really cool. I am so excited because they did a callback to
The Bad
Batch.
There's a little Easter egg there for you.
But the person who hasn't seen The Bad Batch doesn't fucking know.
But does the narrative still function?
That's my point.
Yeah.
It still goes, but there's that neat little moment, you know, that's for me. And for everybody else who watched The Bad Batch. And I feel it's the same way with Marvel a lot of time. Like, if I have to guess, the thing that you need to watch is Loki.
Yeah.
Mm.
I never did see the second season of Loki. So I guess now that's a suggestion.
And there's a whole separate YouTube explainer market now.
Yeah.
Where we'll give you the MCU in 26 minutes. I mean, they're making their own ad revenue.
Dream Crush. Go watch
Dream Crush. Is wonderful.
The Schmoop and Spark Notes of, again, extending the silhouette metaphor. Yeah.
Screen Crush and new rock stars. Yeah, they're all out there doing that. I mean, what you're hitting on, Tracy, makes a lot of sense to me because I've never thought that fandom and academia were that far apart. And this doesn't have to be comic book fandom exclusively. There's always been since I keep reaching back. I want to set a beginning point. This is the dawn of time. We're talking about canonicity is what we're basically talking about here. What is legitimate to the story and what is illegitimate to the story. And I mean, if you want to put this in a religious space, what should be in the Bible and what is apocrypha and doesn't count?
Okay,
if you
we're going to sit here now, David, you and I, we're going to have our own little council of Nicaea.
Let's hash it out right here. This is what we're going to do. I feel Book of Ecclesiastes very strongly. No,
these Gnostic gospels, we're not going in.
But I mean, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, what was legitimate Sherlock Holmes and what could he retroactively change, right?
Yeah. He's not
dead. Epic of Gilgamesh, what is legitimate stuff that we found and what isn't? And then we could go to Star Trek. I'm watching Strange New Worlds and there's a puppet episode. Yeah. And does that count? But this is the same show that's based on Abraham Lincoln in space in the original series. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to me that these questions, this concern, this vying comes up in both the fan sphere and the academic sphere because they're doing the same thing, right? They're using
a whole lot about ideas.
That's right. That's right. And I love the discussion. I wouldn't shut it down, right? I love that this creates energy and interest. I don't like when it shuts people out. I don't like when it says this person can't be cast because of their race or ethnicity or gender, but I don't mind the discussion because it brings in other views and other information. So it totally lines up for me. And I love when my nerd friends go academic and my academic friends go nerd and fandom because it's just different flavors of the same conversation.
Here's the thing that when you talk about canon in comics, if you're reading a Spider-Man comic and there's a crossover, the major event that changes everything won't happen in the other book.
Mm-hmm.
It'll happen in the Spider-Man book, right? They were always really good about that. I will say that Disney with Star Wars has kind of fucked that up because you had people who loved Mando and it was a great show and they ended one season on a thing and they resolved the thing in a different show. And then they did another season. And so when people come back to the new season who didn't watch the other show, they're confused. That's where the narrative breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. In my opinion.
I think that's fair. Well, okay. We can finish the narrative of this episode if we are quick and disciplined about it with Picks of the Week.
we'll get to picks of the week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes. Like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere. But you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month. And that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever. Our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it, a lot of other people are enjoying it, but our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us. And we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
Patrick, can you give us a pick?
I can. So I'm the reason this podcast exists. I am a functional nerd. And I have a lot of electronic devices. I have way more electronic devices now than ever before because of my job, because I have to have an Android phone and an Android tablet and a couple of different iPads and a couple of different laptops and a couple of different desktops and all these things, because I have to test software on all these different things. And one of the things that I have done all my life is I buy canned air. And I will buy canned air as two packs or three packs, usually at an office supply store or sometimes online. And I recently said, I'm not doing that anymore. I got to find an alternative. I hate canned air. Now, I could get the compressor from my garage and bring it upstairs and use that. But I feel like that is overkill to clean stuff.
Possibly.
So what I did was I bought a little handheld device that you charge up, and it has compressed air. Like it just, and it has multiple speeds. It's called the Wolfbox Megaflow 60, and it was $30, and it comes with different connection thealies on it. It says that it can fill like an air mattress if you've got people sleeping over and you need an air mattress. Huh. It can do inner tubes. It can do all kinds of stuff. I charged this a week ago, and it's still showing three bars. Wow. And dots on it. And I have used it to clean every single electronic device in my house. Like I have blown dust out of things that I thought were already blown out, but there was more dust coming out of it. Hold your ears for a second here, because I'm going to.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, it's pretty good.
I also love the name. Wolfbox Megaflow 60 sounds like what a group of kindergartners would name that device.
Yeah, and so. Like the nozzles are interchangeable. You can take them off.
Patrick, I think you just cleaned my shelf here. That's really powerful.
I noticed that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. It comes with a bunch of different kinds of nozzles and connectors that you can do different things with. It saves me from having to constantly buy cans of air and then throw them out and create a bunch of waste. So that's my pick this week. There's my functional nerd pick for you. I haven't done one of those in a while, a technology pick. So
yeah, very fun.
My God.
Okay. David, how about you?
I try to expose myself. No, let's not put it that way. I try to be as aware of different genres and different narratives as much as I can. And I always have a to-be-read list of things I want to get to and explore. I'm about to make the mistake of saying something that I'm not sure how it's pronounced. I've only read it. All right. But I finally have gotten to reading Witch Hat Atelier.
That's my favorite show, and it ended already, and I want season two. Damn it.
Well, I haven't gotten to the viewing yet. I'm still in the reading mode here. My local library has stocked up. We're starting from volume one. I got so hooked on volume one, I'm now buying them. And I'm sharing them not only with my kids, but with my partner, but with my friends. It is so sincere and beautiful and charming.
And gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. It's doing nice things for, for my soul.
Yeah.
And it's very entertaining. So I'm very late to this, but it certainly has my recommendation. I'm just chewing through the volumes with delight.
I don't know where you are, but the show is great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
But the thing is, like my friend who's helping me with Crunchyroll stuff right now, mm-hmm. I'm on a Crunchyroll adventure. Said, yeah, we're watching that too. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then I watched an episode and I sent him, I'm like, man, this is killing me. I wish they weren't doing like one episode a week. I really want the next episode. And there was a really long, long pause in the text. And he goes, you know, that was the season finale, right? I'm like, no, no!
I'm not privileging the book, the manga, over the anime. I mean, they both have delightful things. I do like to do the reading first so that I imagine the character voices and I imagine how they move before it's shown to me. I'm looking forward to that as well.
I will say I have discovered there's an entire YouTube genre of what the anime left out.
Oh yeah, cool.
You can watch, and so a lot of times I will look those up because I'm trying not to spend a ton of money on manga, but we'll see how that goes. Yeah. Good pick. I like
nice.
That.
Thanks.
Nice. I love how excited you were with each other there. It was very
fun. and because I never remember it, I always say Witch Hat at a girl.
My French is terrible. I know it's an English word that we borrowed from the French. Atelier. I used to do WHA. How's WHA?
Yeah.
Volume of WHA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So fantastic. I'll round out the picks of the week with a pick, which is a graphic novel, and it is a nonfiction graphic novel. In this case, it is The History of Science Fiction, a graphic novel adventure. So this was published a few years ago, and the creators, I'm going to mangle their names here, so many apologies, are Xavier Dolo and Jibril Morissette-Fonn. And they, as you would imagine from the nature of the title there, kind of cover the infancy of science fiction as we understand it up to pretty close to the present, including lots of sort of explorations of its intersections with different historical moments and historical movements and the influence of different specific authors. And so if graphic novels and comics are a format that you like, but you're also really interested in maybe the history of something bigger that you like as well, like science fiction, I think that you can get a lot of utility and some real enjoyment out of The History of Science Fiction, a graphic novel adventure.
That's
cool. I love it.
Yeah.
You know, I back in the day, one of my paid gigs was for Kirkus.
Yeah.
Was writing up reviews of graphic novels that had nothing to do with superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
That was difficult. It was difficult to find. It was difficult to find stuff. So I was doing a lot of literary adaptations and Brandon Sanderson and Wizard of Oz. And
there are more of those these days than
Paper Girls.
To
I did Paper Girls back in the day. Was a good one.
Lumberjanes.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, David, it has been lovely talking to you. So
thank you both. Folks,
where can they find you, the works that you create, and get more familiar with all of your intellectual output?
Sure. I am I'm on Insta as a.davidlewis. I have a.davidlewis.com. I'm sure I have a listing on Amazon and at your local library. And if you're in the Boston area, come look me up. I'm part of the Boston Comic Arts Foundation and any number of wonderful organizations out here.
It sounds like you're wicked smart.
I'm a wicked pisser smart. I go to Harvard. I park my car at Harvard.
Yeah.
And I get $3.50 for a burger. It's great.
There you go.
There you go.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the-functional-nerds on Facebook. At functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY, .social. I know. I couldn't keep it copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching. If you want me, it's ATFMB because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent, so you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions, and then squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay, that's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.